Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Harmon and Jason Spin the Yarn. This intro is being added in post because we kind of forgot to add one last time, and so here it is. We're going to be talking about personal finance and all that entails. Enjoy.
Last time we did end on a bit of a quick note, and it was a bit crunched up. We were talking about if you don't understand something, you probably shouldn't invest in it. But obviously the question is, and the challenge is that there are a lot of things that people don't understand when it comes to finance, personal finance specifically. So I thought it would be cool to talk a little bit about that, how we approach a, first of all, personal finance, and maybe go into a couple of the topics that we think are the most important things to know. I think we got to do the obligatory caveat that we're not financial experts, so we're not going to be dishing out any advice. It's just
although kind of we will be saying things that are useful.
Yes, it's things that are useful, our own opinions, and not necessarily advice. And maybe one of the things we can touch on before the end of the session is just to explain where people can get advice and how people go about exploring some of these concepts. One of the main things that I think is like critical for everyone to understand when it comes to money, the way that inflation works is basically someone has decided that there's certain items that are required for life. This is called the basket of goods. And every so often, they do basically a census and they collect data on things like, you know, how much is petrol? How much is it for a loaf of bread? How much is it for all of these different items in this basket? And then comes to a price. And this is usually called the consumer price index. And inflation is usually the addition or the increase or decrease in that amount. So inflation would be an increase, deflation would be a decrease. I think it's important because it kind of sets in motion something that you need to understand when it comes to personal finance, is that money, when it's standing still, is going to lose its real spending power. So basically what happens is that if I have 100 rands today, I can buy certain things. I can buy like a certain amount of petrol. Next year, because of inflation, because the price goes up, my 100 rand can only buy me less petrol. So my spending power or my purchasing power has reduced.
A really good illustration of this is when you talk to old people and they're like, back in my day, petrol was so cheap because I could go and I could fill up my entire car for 100 rand. And the fact of the matter that they could fill up their entire car for 100 rand, but it's a false equation over there because it doesn't take into account that 100 rand then is not equal to 100 rand now. So petrol wasn't that much cheaper back then. It was cheaper, but it wasn't that much cheaper back then.
Yeah.
And talk about like inflation adjusted values when talking about historical values.
Yeah. And it's also compounding, right? Because this year, 4%, next year, it's 4%. So there's kind of like an additional sort of increase. And I think the thing that's important that I always think about is in South Africa, it's quite prominent. And you usually understand this in the sense that people get like, usually get a bump in their salary around about the beginning of the year sometime. And that's to adjust for inflation. But in the developing economies like the US and the UK, they do have inflation, but it's so small. It's usually like 1 or 2%. That's not very noticeable. So I think now with all of the energy crisis stuff and a lot of the sort of cost of living crisis that they talk about in the UK, it's really related to that effect, right? You're losing your power of money. Your spending power is reducing. So you can buy less things. And when it comes to things like food, that can put you into a pretty nasty situation. So what is the way that you counteract that, Herman?
Well, so that's by putting your money to work, right? Is, as you said, money, when it stagnates, it doesn't gain any value. So this is the whole like putting your money in a mattress, is it turns out that that's not a very useful thing to do, because 20 years later, it will have significantly less actual power. So the most common ways to keep or increase the purchasing power of your money is to invest it into things like stocks and bonds, property, Pokemon cards, which I don't recommend, but it's it is a a class of speculative asset. And so the thing that the way that these essentially increase the amount of relative value that you have is through two means. The first one is the increasing of the actual price of that stock, bond, object, etc. So let's take, for instance, you buy Apple stock when it is $10, and 20 years later, it's worth $10,000. Well, you've made a 10,000% return on that investment specifically through the buying and selling of that. But then that brings us to the second way that investments make money, and that's through dividends. So this is more pertinent to stocks where you actually own a piece of a company. And by owning that piece of a company, you essentially get payouts in like profit payouts relative to your ownership stake in that company. And so if you have, you know, 10,000 stock of X or of a unit trust, then you would also get, depending on when their payout period is, X amount based on the amount of stake that you have in that vehicle. And so those are the two main ways that you do it. Another way to think about this is kind of like if you buy a property and you can make money both from buying that property and then selling it at a higher price at a later date, but also from rental income, right? Yeah. And so those are the different mechanisms in which you make money with your money.
Yeah. And we did speak about buying versus renting, I think, in episode 28, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm pretty against like properties, but as you mentioned in that episode, it is an effective way to save. I think one of the biggest things you need to learn when it comes to personal finance is this concept of delayed gratification. Being able to basically put aside your current enjoyment so that you can have the rewards later down the line. Unfortunately, for most people, that is quite a hard thing to do. So a house actually acts almost like a forced way of building capital. So when we talk about like saving, you can usually just say you're like, you know, building capital. Saving in the sense of just having cash in the bank is okay, but it's not really an asset in most cases. It is able to buy you things that are assets, like a stock would be, I would say, is more of an asset. And these are like quite hard terms to understand, I guess, if you've never heard of them before. But like the term asset is something that's going to accrue value to you. So stocks can do this. Certain other products can do this. We've got things like ETFs can do this. The benefit is that, yeah, as you mentioned, you can get dividends and you get value that gets added on top of that. It's really interesting to think about it because as a company that's publicly traded, the CEO is incentivized to deliver more value. So you've got some mechanism in that process that's trying to drive value into that stock price. So that you could kind of think of it as that would be a little bit more valuable than just having cash, which just sits in a bank. And in most cases, you can get deposits, like safety deposits or secured deposits, where you get a specific amount from the bank in exchange for them lending it out. These options do exist, but what I tend to find is it's not always inflation beating in that sense, unless you have a really long time horizon. You know, we're talking like 5-year time horizon where you basically lock away your money. So the house option is a way to lock away your money, but you also have the ability to rent out that house if you need to, which is quite cool. So question, have you heard about FIRE?
Yes. Let me see if I can get this acronym right. It is financial independence, retire early.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It's, and I thought, it's kind of like the whole Mr. Money mustache. You know, what you do is you essentially save as much money as you possibly can during your early working career and retire early because you've got so much money saved, or not necessarily saved, but invested.
Yeah. So I don't quite know what I think about this, and it's more just to like add a little bit of flavor into the podcast. But basically, you like deprive yourself, so delayed gratification on like times 100. You basically eat baked beans for dinner every night. You live in like a shoebox, and you squirrel away all of your money. You never go out to eat for dinner with your friends. And basically, you do that in a way so that you can save between, I think the recommendation is between like 40 to 60% of your salary is going into saving. And by doing that, you can take advantage potentially of compounding, which might not be that effective in the early stages, because compounding kind of only really takes off once you get into like the higher numbers. You deprive yourself, you don't see your friends, you sit in a small room for a long time, and eventually you work out like a certain number. And there's this rule, they call it the 4% rule. So if you can take the amount of money that you have and you can take 4% of that, and that's what you can live on for a year, then you can kind of say that you would be able to effectively draw that money out and live effectively without diminishing that initial capital. Is it something that you subscribe to, or is it something that you appreciate?
Well, I think that was a very brutal summary that you gave, but it wasn't entirely incorrect. So here's the thing, is that we are currently in a world where we'll probably carry on living. We're going to carry on working until we die. Right? Is most people, and this is all due to the housing market. So I just want to throw that out there. Is when old people are like, oh yeah, I managed to buy my first house on my minor salary, and had, you know, my wife worked at home and my wife was just the housekeeper with our three children, and it's like, that's impossible today because of salaries have increased a very small amount since, you know, the 1950s, whereas housing prices has increased multiple hundreds of percent in relative value. And so putting money away is important, but I think it is more important for financial blows than actual retirement. I think that you should also save for retirement, just putting that out there. Mm. But the fact of the matter is that no one is going to save their way to riches, and they're certainly not going to do that and be young. And so that's the unfortunate thing, is that the only way to become wealthy is to increase your income, right?
Yes.
And no one really wants to hear that, which is why there's so many courses telling you how to day trade and how to, you know, flip houses and everything, because, or you know, there's books about how you can play with your credit card points until you become rich. And the fact of the matter is that like people who are wealthy didn't do it that way. The writer of that book didn't do it that way. They got wealthy off of selling that book, right? They created something of value in a market and they sold it. Mm. So when I have a personal philosophy when it comes to investing, and it doesn't necessarily include retirement, although I'm privileged to be able to retire early if I wanted to, because I have, you know, a business or two that work okay. But I also am very, very much aware that like I will get fucking bored if I mean, like even today, the reason why I was late to this podcast is because I was just moping about on the couch because I like ran out of things to do, and I'm like, my life is a fucking lie. Oh,
yeah.
What's the point of living? And so I think for the majority of people, it is important to contribute to a retirement annuity so that if they do get to old age, they don't necessarily have to work, or at least they don't have to work shit, right? Like they'll at least have some money coming in and they can bartend so they can hang out with their buddies or something.
Yeah, it really is a trade-off, right? You know, with everything in life, it's about trade-offs, and, you know, FIRE is one approach to take. I don't necessarily, so I quite subscribe to the minimalist philosophy of FIRE, but I think you're definitely right. It's sometimes about the journey and not necessarily the destination that matters. So when it comes to like going for a beer, you're like splurging every now and like really nice coffees, like, you know, I'm going to rather enjoy that and try and work a little bit harder. And I think I also agree with what you said there. And I saw it was in a recent blog post of yours. You can't save your way to riches. And it's really about like cash flow, right? Cash flow is probably the most important thing. And if you ever start a business, people say like cash flow is king. Because what that allows you to do is it allows you to put it into other things, right? So if you think about lots of forms of income that's coming in, you have the ability to pay off a loan, right? And this is one of the most exciting and one of the most, I would say, the biggest hacks in finance. And when it comes to like, especially like very wealthy people, the way that they approach things like credit and how they use credit to leverage their way to more and more wealth rather than spending what they have, right?
So, okay, I'm going to drop my opinions on investing, right? And you can just let me know what you think of them, because I think that they're counterintuitive to a lot of what you'll like, a lot of the advice that you'll get nowadays. But if you speak to anyone who has a robust portfolio, this is the way that they invest. Is they do not if they just put. And I just put my money into a index tracker, right? All of my excess cash goes into an index tracker. And so that grows along with the stock market. The fact of the matter is that no one beats the stock market for a prolonged period of time, right? No one. Okay, there are three people who do beat the stock market. Those are insider traders, which are illegal. It's certified geniuses who are, you know, like, change the actual fundamentals of the investing landscape when they do this, or people who just got incredibly, incredibly lucky, right? Is that even people who they study their entire lives to become analysts for like big Wall Street firms do not outperform the stock market over a 20-year period, right? And so the fact of the matter is that I am not a PhD quant, and I'm not going to outperform the stock market over a 20-year period. So I can perform at the stock market level. So that's what I should do. And anything that, any investments that look really tantalizing because they're going vertical, they can go vertical in both directions. That's actually the hallmark of a very unstable asset class or an unstable stock or whatever, is that if it's moving about a lot, it's actually not a robust investment and the price point isn't set properly. And so by taking excess, like your excess capital and putting it into a big old bunch of stocks that increase in value over time and pay dividends, right, is the only reliable way to make money over the long term. And you could do the same thing by like buying property.
I think the caveat is that you're talking about passive making money, right?
Sure. I mean, this is about investing.
The thing is investing and personal finance. So along with things like cash flow, it's really about like, first of all, diversification and the return that you can get on any endeavor, right? So you can, by all means, the index funds, ETFs are very good. Basically, it's usually like top 10, or if it's S&P, it's like the top 100 companies. There's a specific way that they split those different, shares, and they just buy them and hold them for a very, very long time. And you get exposure to a wide variety of companies. Okay, you know, Apple's quite big, so you're probably going to have, you know, a little bit more exposure to the tech companies than you might have for other things. But if you were to take that money and instead of putting it into an ETF and you then go and start a business or you buy a property that you can rent out, you've actually increased your cash flow obviously your business has to be a bit more successful. You increase your cash flow, you increase the money that comes in, And then you can put that into work into another thing. So you can have that money that comes in then go into an ETF because then you've got constant flow of money that's coming in. And if that's going into ETFs, that's going to accumulate and accumulate and accumulate.
Yeah.
So, but it's about how you get to that cash flow. And that's where we come into like things like return on investment, right? So like how much money do you put in? How much money do you get out? And what is the value that comes out of it, right? So you've got like, I've maybe taken 100, maybe 10,000 Rand. Instead of investing it, which would probably get about 4%, I go and start a business. That business maybe generates 1,000 Rand a month. Then I've got like 12,000 Rand a year. So from that 10,000 Rand, I've gotten 12,000 Rand a year as cash flow. And then your return investment is like about 220%, right? So you've got money coming in for nothing. And then the best people, they don't even use that 10,000 Rand that they have. They use credit to get that 10,000 Rand because that's a good form of credit because the good form of credit is that you're using that money to try and get more money, right? You're not using it to just buy a car or, you know, buy a nice vacuum cleaner or a microwave. You know?
Right. Well, so I realize that this podcast episode has the ability to like balloon out into a lot. So when it comes to like passive investing advice, that there's a old saying that like that advice can fit on a postcard, right? It's put money into index trackers and leave it the fuck alone. Actually, you don't even need a whole podcast. A whole postcard for that. As far as accumulating wealth is concerned. What you said is entirely true is that if you use property as an example, you manage to buy one property, you can mortgage that property out, you can mortgage that property and use that to get a really, really inexpensive loan to buy another property. And now you've got two properties in your portfolio and the bank is like, this guy pays his stuff back. So they essentially give you more and more credit and more and more credit. However, that generally only works during like an up property market. So there's a bunch of YouTubers right now who are like, I am such a smart man because I made so much money in the property market. And the fact of the matter is that there were incredibly smart people in the property market in 2007 who didn't fare nearly as well. So it also really depends on luck a lot. And that also applies to starting a business is that businesses fail. Okay, let me rephrase that. Startups fail. Businesses have a lower failure rate. Like if you start a corner store, you'll probably make some money, right? You'll probably be all right. It's not going to be lucrative because it doesn't have that same amount of leverage, right? You're servicing the surrounding area. If you start selling kombucha, maybe you start making an extra 2,000 Rand a month. Whereas if you start an internet business and you move into different markets and you pivot and you now have 200,000 users, that's a completely different lever that you can pull.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot to cover here.
There's definitely a lot. One, maybe a question to pose to you is, in your personal experience, how would you know that you've made it? Would you say that you've made it now?
That's a very good question. I don't know, right? I mean, the metric is a really tough one because the way that we kind of quantify making it in the West is by being extraordinarily wealthy. But I don't have aspirations to be extraordinarily wealthy. However, at the same time, I don't really have aspirations to have like a life full of leisure because I can do that right now and it's really fucking boring.
You don't have any ideas of like Scrooge McDucking into the pile of money and swimming around.
Turns out gold is really hard. So when you dive into your swimming pool of gold coins, you actually just end up with a broken face.
Yes, exactly.
But I'd say that I'm in a very good place right now. I manage my own time. I have money for things that I want to spend money on. I don't really want for anything, which is very different to 3 years ago where I was living paycheck to paycheck. And it is a very liberating feeling. And I would definitely say that my mental health has improved because of that. Because while it's true that money doesn't make you happy, a lack of money definitely does make you stressed.
Yes. So there's a guy on Twitter, I think it's Naval, who says, like, if you have to choose between like money and not having money, like focus on money first and then focus on the happiness. Because my approach is that, yes, like there's a diminishing return as you go higher and higher up. But if you can't afford to like buy yourself a meal or you can't afford to feed yourself, that's definitely a bad place to be in. And especially with things like inflation, it's important to know what that boundary is of like how much is the minimum you need to spend. If you're a student now, I would recommend trying to see what that low point is. So when I was in university, like I kind of took it as a challenge to see like what would be my benchmark minimum that I need to survive in terms of like food and like those kind of things. And knowing where that point is quite important, especially if you're like, you know, hovering around that point. Because one thing that can happen is, especially with things outside of your control, you know, rent could get increased, you know, the petrol price, if you're quite dependent on that petrol price, that can increase. And then all of a sudden, you like, you don't have enough money for buying like food and those kind of things. For me, like one of the great things is always being able to like kind of go to the shops and just buy what I want and not really look at the labels.
It's very refreshing to not do that.
It's very refreshing to be able to do that. Although in the UK here, things are a little bit like more pricey than in South Africa. So I do have to do a little bit of a check every now and again.
So if we take a couple steps back and talk about how do you get to that point of increasing your income to the extent, because as we've said, it's like it's really difficult to kick off without cash, right? Mm-hmm. Is if you want to get into the investment game or whatever, is you need to have cash and preferably a lot of it. And so when we look at the risk profile of starting a business or a startup, it's actually really high. There's a very high chance of failure, and then there's a very large entry cost. Then you have, let's just talk about university professions, right? So on the low end of the spectrum, you have something like drama, right? If you go and do a degree in drama, it's going to be a fairly low cost degree, and it's not going to be that taxing of a degree when, say, compared to studying medicine. Mm. However, when you get out of university, there's a very good chance that you're actually not going to work in the field, and you're not guaranteed an income. If you go into a very high profile degree, so law, medicine, and things like that, there's a very high entry cost in terms of work that needs to be done. It is difficult to graduate as a electronic engineer or as a doctor. I mean, like doctors have what, 7 years to get through? It's expensive. Yeah. It's time consuming. It's mentally taxing. But once you do that, you're pretty much guaranteed to be in the 1% of top earners in your country or in the world, right? There is a caveat over here. In South Africa, it is in your best interest to get a university degree. And if we're not talking about like medicine or law, because there's a shortfall for that, and tertiary education over here isn't that expensive. However, if you're in the United States, there's actually an overabundance of qualified individuals and not enough jobs in university educated professions. But where the really good money is in trades. So if you can go and upskill as a carpenter or a welder or a mechanist of some form, there's stories of like there not being enough carpenters, and so carpenters are now charging like $100 an hour, which is, you know, like high level software engineering.
We've touched on this before, right? I think one of the most lucrative professions is like a plumber, right? Because it's also, unfortunately, the way the world works is a little bit different to how people think. There kind of needs to be a demand for your skill in whichever country you're working in to be able to have a beneficial, you know, outcome from that degree, right? You know, in South Africa, take a look at what's not working, right? You've got factories, the energy supply, You've got agriculture. These are all the places where you need to like focus on. Like, sure, it's nice to get like a drama degree and become a like an actor. I think there's a place for that, but you really need to think about these kind of things when it goes into choosing like which degrees you go for. And then the other thing, you mentioned law, you mentioned doctors. The challenge with those professions I see is that there's a one-to-one ratio of work to pay. For a doctor, if you don't come to work, there's no value that you're creating, right? And if you, for instance, can't come to work, then you lose your earning power. The same with lawyers. If you don't have clients, you don't have business, you don't have money coming in. Obviously, with lawyers, it's a little bit easier than a doctor, because doctors usually work on a kind of inside of a partner, in a partnership. The challenge with that points out is that that's a direct influence of work to income. And this is what comes in when you think about entrepreneurs and specifically coders, is that if you can do something once and then at a higher level, figure out what's going to make it easier for you to do it the next time, then you can start to compound your knowledge into, you know, templates, things that will make it easier to do that again the next time. And then also you'll be able to outsource some of those things. So if, say, for instance, you have one customer, they want to build a website. You like, okay, you graft through, you build that first website, right? Really hard work. The second time it happens, you've already got a template for that. So you can kind of have a little bit easier. So you can start to accumulate knowledge that can help you to advance your ability to earn more money. And that compounding is what is the difference between entrepreneurs and those one-on-one professions. And it happens in some of them, like engineering, those kind of things. You really need to think about outside of that mindset, like how do you get above that? And how do you get something that can have an exponential increase in your ability?
So I think it's useful to think of that by defining it into three different things, right? Is I hate the term side hustle, right? And I hate the term entrepreneur because they're terribly, terribly misused, right? Is I think it's more useful to categorize the non-employed forms of work, as in you're not working for a company as a employed person, in terms of gigs, small business owner, or sorry, small businesses, and then entrepreneur, startup, or whatever you want to call it. The gig is you're not working for yourself. You're working for Uber. You just do gigs for them. Right, you're not a small business owner because your income is directly reliant on someone else's platform that sends you work and sets the prices, et cetera, et cetera. Right, so you've got your gigs, then you've got your small businesses, and the small businesses are not novel. They're something that have been done before. You start a cafe, corner store, a nursery, whatever, and you're not pioneering something. And also there's no big leverage, right? So if you start let's take for instance, a shop that sells plants, and then you think, oh, what would be pretty interesting is if I franchise this, or I started an online store and franchise the online store to different locations around the world. And so essentially became like a hub of, or the place that people go to get plants pretty much anywhere. Think of like Amazon for plants, right? That takes me to the third one, and that's your entrepreneur or your startup, where you're doing something novel and you're doing something that scales. And I think it's useful to think about it in terms of those three things. All three of them are viable options, although I would definitely say that your earning is limited in the gig economy, because the economics of that have been fully shut.
Yeah. So I think for those getting started, like, okay, it's not in every environment, right? We don't have Uber that's, you know, penetrating everywhere in South Africa. Like here we've got like these really like fast delivery services, like, you know, Deliveroo is one of them. They've got Getter. They've got a lot of these like just in time delivery services. So it's a little bit easier to get a gig job. I think like gig jobs are, especially the ones where you like have some physical output, you got to think about like, what is the value, right? You've got any business, anywhere that you're getting money, you have to be generating that amount of value, or else you're not a valuable person. If it's a company, you got to always have this in the back of your mind. Gigs are a good way to bootstrap, I would say, to those first stages. In terms of, like, you know, generating a little bit more income, if you're like,
and you still own your time,
you still own your time. But what is the value there? You're exchanging your physical ability for something of value, right? And this is kind of, you know, if you have mine workers in the back in the day, and you have like rail workers, what were they doing? They were just hitting nails. They were just expending physical energy to get value. And this is probably like touching on some of your communist vibes in a sense, but then you got to think about like what else
production.
Yeah, exactly. But then there's also like, I think thinking of outside of the box, obviously I can't speak for other people, but like there's definitely a value in outside of that one thing, right? If you're driving around, what else are you doing? Like, are you, you know, seeing different areas in a more frequent way, right? Are you able to then take that data and do something with it? One of the examples I had that I heard about once was someone was delivering, they were repairing DSTVs or satellite television sets, right? So they were just doing this delivery. They were going to people's houses, like basically fixing the DSTV for those satellite television, whatever. What they didn't realize is that what they were actually doing as well is they were starting to map out who in a specific area had television, right? So as a marketer, you might want to know the demographics of who's viewing the television. So what they actually were doing is they were doing this repair job, but they actually had a hidden value in that they actually knew who had TVs and who didn't and what were their demographic. So the person then went and sold that to marketing people so that they could understand their audience a bit better and then deliver more pertinent videos or like TV ads or whatever. So there was a hidden value in what they're doing. And it takes a little bit of like thinking outside of the box of how are you adding value and what value can you extract from what you're doing already. And another thing to think about, and one that we haven't really talked about much, is like, for me, the first thing that I did when I got a job was that I built up a emergency fund. And even before you start investing, it's good to have this backup fund. And I usually have about like 3 to 6 months salary. And that is specifically for cases where you potentially get laid off. But it also gives you a bit more freedom. Like,
it's difficult to do that.
It's difficult to do that.
I'll be completely honest, is I never managed to build up an emergency fund until my business actually kicked off. Is I had intentions of building up an emergency fund, but I always bumped into the end of my salary at the end of the month. And so ended up digging into my savings. And that is coming from a person who works in a fairly lucrative field already. And so I'd say that the majority of the population has a tough time doing that, despite it probably being the most important financial advice that you can give to someone.
Yeah. So the way I get around that, right, is this concept of pay yourself first, right? And I've done this like since my very first job, so it's not even like where I am now. The pay yourself first model is basically as your salary comes into your account, you take out how much you want to spend. So similar to the FIRE movement, you take a certain percentage, like 10%, and you put that into savings. And then you basically live off the rest. And that's why I did the baseline of like what's the minimum I need to survive. And then once you've got that last bit, I just like use that as I would do on a normal basis. And I forget about the money that I've saved away. So you would do this in a general sense if you had a house, because you'd be paying that off at the beginning of the month by like some debit order or whatever. But that pay yourself first mentality of like, let me put some money away and then I just spend the rest. It's a little bit easier for me to get to do that. And it's allowed me to kind of build up a little bit of capital that I can use to have a bit more freedom in what I do, because I'm not constantly worried about losing my job, because I have a certain amount of capacity to recover from that. And that's a very important thing. A lot of people get thrown into poverty because of a certain thing that happens and they don't have the capacity to absorb that challenge. So for instance, you might you know be living day like week to week or month to month, and then your car breaks down and then you have to pay for fixing your car, and then you don't have cash available for that. And so then you have to go and get a loan, and then you get maybe a loan shark who's the only one who can like conceivably give you that money.
Or credit cards.
Or it's a credit card.
Legal loan sharks.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges is being able to survive a surprise bill is mm-hmm. very important to your personal finance and to be able to weather the storm when things go wrong.
I'll definitely say that, yeah, having a emergency fund or the ability to take a big financial knock is also, it's good to, you know, in case something happens, but it also makes you a lot less risk averse, which is important when it comes to starting a new venture or changing jobs or something like that. Is some people cannot change jobs because they can't take the downtime that would be between them, or they would like to start a business, but there is no way that they could attempt it because they don't have access to that capital.
Yeah.
And I'm not even talking about the capital of starting a business. I mean, the capital of surviving while they test their thing. And so just having that little amount is important. So what happened with me personally is while I was still working at my last job, I was also mentoring at a tech school in Accra in Ghana. And during my time there, they paid me a stipend, a living stipend, and fed and housed me. And the living stipend was generous, and I had excess of that left over. But the important thing is that I actually managed to take my entire salary and put that directly into savings for 3 months. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that I had a big chunk of savings. Once I had those savings in my account, it was about 2 or 3 months later that I'm like, actually, I'm going to try doing my own thing because yeah. I could, right? I could never have made the jump into being my own boss, running my own business without having that financial stability of knowing that if things go terribly, I can survive for 4 or 5 months, right?
But that also
depends. I can find another job.
Yeah, so that also like it also hinges on the fact that you have skills that are valuable to the market that you're operating in. What I also like about that story is it shows that in order to get ahead, sometimes you do need to take a bit of a risk. Even if you're employed, if you ever like for me, like having that backup like fund just makes me a little bit more. I would say, I wouldn't say like adversarial, but like a little, I take a few more risks even within the company because I'm not afraid of, you know, manager X coming down on me and like,
yeah, you know, if your boss is shit to you, like actually shit to you, you can be like, fuck you.
Exactly. Exactly.
If this isn't resolved, then you can leave. You can reasonably leave.
Exactly. It gives you a little bit more freedom. I'm not always like watching my back. I'm not doing anything dodgy. To try and like make, you know, like kiss up to people because I do have a little bit of a safety net. And it's just a lot more freeing knowing about that. But it does hinge on the fact that, you know, you have to have skills, you have to have the confidence to know that you can always recover if you need to, which is not always for everyone's case. I do understand that. But, you know, I think in order to get ahead, there is an element of risk. And that just needs to be, you know, whether it's saving up for a bit or, you know, being a little bit more cautious. The other side of it is as you do progress and as you start to get a little bit of income, it's important to think about the hedonic curve of like once you have a certain amount, especially if you get a raise, people immediately like buy a nice car or they like maybe go into a new place. The reason I'm like in a small room in London is because I don't want to be burdened by that curve. So I'm, you know, I don't want to like rent an apartment that's way outside of
But you also already are. Like the thing with the hedonic curve is that it's subtle, right? An example of what we were talking about earlier where we go to the grocery store and we don't look at the labels, right? That's an example of the hedonic curve. Oh, yeah. When I look at the labels, I can buy groceries. I can buy the expensive groceries if I want, right? And that's the more insidious side of it because like your rent is a big one, right? Your rent is a decision that you look at that number and you're like, can I afford this? And it is a good example of the hedonic curve in action But I think the more insidious ones are like the small expenses. You know, you go out for dinner and you spend 500 rand on dinner out. And like, I now do that and I don't even think about it. Like the check comes and I pay for it and off I go. Whereas 500 rand bill, while I was still working as a game developer, man, that would have like taken out a quarter of my going out budget for the month.
Yeah. Also moving to London, like I definitely feel that a lot more, right? Like in South Africa, you can go out a few more times. I think here I'm more very much actively aware of how many times I can go out, especially if it's like anywhere near like middle to top tier restaurants. It really does like take a knock.
I felt that way when I went to New York. I was like, in South Africa, I'm fairly well paid, having a good time. In New York, it's like, oh, every time you go out, it's going to cost you 1,000 rand. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah, it is a bit daunting, right? But the way, like, one approach that is good to think about in terms of that is setting a reasonable percentage of your income or of your salary, right? So if, for instance, you want a car, right? And I don't have a car, obviously, again, because of the hedonic stuff, and maybe because I don't necessarily need one that desperately. Think about in terms of like what percentage of your income can you attribute to different things, right? So one thing that's non-negotiable for me is I save a certain percentage of my money every month at the beginning of as the money hits my account, it immediately goes out and I put that into investments like we talked about before. Then I would say, how much would I reasonably want to spend on rent per month, right? And I have a certain percentage that I set as like a threshold, right? So that way you can always stay reasonably bounded within your different expense categories. And how you do that is how you break it down in terms of like a budget. If you need a car, you would probably attribute, I don't know, like what, 10% to, you know, 20%, depends on what your needs are. If you travel for a living, if you go door to door or you do a lot of traveling, maybe it makes sense to have a bit of a nicer car so that you get a little bit of a, you know, a bit of enjoyment from your life. But if it's not a big expense for you, maybe you need to do 10%, right? Or 5%. And then how much you spend on rent. Do you prefer to have a nicer house? Okay, I'll attribute 30% to 40% of my costs. And then you break it down like that. And as you progress, you always stay within those boundaries. And it's also important to think it's not just the payments on the car. It's the maintenance. It's the insurance. All of those bundled together. And then you can go and, you know, shop around and say, what can you reasonably afford? And that way you stay within the hedonic curve. You stay a little bit sheltered from certain, price increases in certain cases, and always have that buffer to be able to withstand that small amount of a knock if it does ever come up.
That's fair. That's fair. I think that's a healthy way to look at it. To wrap up, I'd like to say that if you are just investing and you're a regular human, you should never be looking at candle charts, right? Candle charts are not for you, and if you are looking at them, then you are wasting your time and you are being duped. Let's actually end off this episode with a quick thought experiment. So if we have three different people and each of those people is given 10,000 rand every year, right? At the beginning of the year, the first person, as soon as he gets the 10,000 rand, he puts it into an index tracker. The second person, he is incredibly intelligent, a bona fide quant, and he manages to find the perfect bottom of the market every year, and he puts the 10,000 rand into the market at the perfect bottom, so it only goes up. Then the third person is like the bona fide quant, except he's completely useless, and he manages to buy at the perfect top of the stock market each year. So he's terribly unlucky. Over a 20-year period, who has the most money?
I mean, if you can find the bottom every single time, I would say that guy.
So that is the general consensus. People think that it would be the bottom of the market. It turns out it's actually the person who puts it into the market right at the beginning, because their money spends significantly more time in the market, if over the 20-year period, the bottom of the market would be on average in the middle of the year. That means that the person who puts it into the tracker at the beginning of the year, on average over the 20-year period, has twice as much time in the market than the person who puts it in at the perfect bottom. And it's the whole adage of time in the market beats timing the market. Interestingly enough, all three of these characters are actually going to do okay in the long run, because they are all investing on a regular basis 10,000 rand, and they never withdraw it, and they never sell right until they reach the end of the 20-year period. So in this little thought experiment, they all actually do okay, but the person who puts it in first every time is the person who actually does the best.
That's awesome.